inconceivable!
Hey, Doc, we better back up. We don't have enough road to get up there.
Roads? Where we're going, we don't need roads.
Hello, all you Motor City movie lovers. We're so glad to see you again at the Good Trash Genre Cast. And if you haven't guessed already, we're going to be looking at a movie called The Crow today. Before we get into that, we need to do some introductions. My name is Dustin Sells. I study movies at the University of Central Oklahoma, and maybe someday I will write things about them. To my left.
I am Dalton at Can't Rain All the Time, Stewart. I used to study...
You're welcome.
I used to study sociology at the University of Central Oklahoma, but then they gave me a degree and a swift kick on the ass, so I don't go there anymore.
Excellent. To my right.
Well, congratulations, Dylan. I am Arthur Gordon, and let's let the party get started.
Fire it up! Fire it up! Fire it up!
Okay.
All right. Well, we are obviously very enthused to be talking about the movie we're talking tonight. It is a cult classic. It is Brandon Lee's The Crow, also Alex Proyas's The Crow, and we're just really, really thrilled to do what we do. We're going to do a little bit of analysis after a quick thumbs up, thumbs down, but before we do any of that, we're going to have to do a synopsis. And for the synopsis, we're going to have the voice of the theater, Mr. Arthur Gordon, again, release those dulcet, velvety tones and let us know that synopsis, sir.
A man, brutally murdered, comes back to life as an undead avenger of his and his fiancée's murder.
Very good, very good. It's a revenge movie, if you haven't guessed.
It is.
And we're going to do our quick...
Vengeance is had.
It is.
By all.
There is a bit
all
of
by one.
Well, you know, he stuck all his blades and all of his major organs in alphabetical order.
How does he know it's alphabetical order? Who gives a shit? It's awesome.
So there's brilliant. A lot of that that goes on. Let's do our quick thumbs up, thumbs down, as if you have to guess. And then we will move on to some analysis. I begin to my right, Mr. Arthur Gordon. Thumbs up, thumbs down. What do you think? What works? What doesn't?
You know, guys, this is a definite two thumbs up for me. I think this is a film of strong pacing. I love the pacing here.
Yeah, buddy.
There's not a boring moment to be had. I like the visual style. It's got that nice thing we see. I'll hit on it later, but we see in some late 80s films. It's got a good soundtrack. It's a nice soundtrack. I really, one of the things I came away with this movie, though, is Ernie Hudson and Michael Wincott.
Yeah,
are a blast.
Uh-huh.
And so I...
Speaking of actors from the 80s that we miss.
Exactly. Ernie, come back to us.
That's right. And Michael Wincott.
Michael Wincott was awesome.
I feel like... Yeah.
Arthur, I was afraid you wouldn't be able to join us this evening on account of a slight case of death. Boy, Michael Wincott's the best. He totally makes Alien Resurrection, which is not a good movie.
Into a watchable film.
Yeah, he's awesome. I love Michael
Wincott. I like him a lot.
Sorry, that was...
That's it, you like it.
I streamline things.
Well, Mr. Stewart.
I'm not good at that. going into this, I love this movie. I grew up with this film. Like, this is a... Probably explains a lot about me, actually. This is an integral part of my
Explains
child.
The long hair and makeup.
You caught me.
Yeah.
This was an integral part of my formative film years. I will say, Roscoe also grew up watching this film. Thank you, Roscoe the dog. I hadn't watched this in a number of years, and since the last time I'd watched it, it has diminished a bit for me. Now, it's not to say I don't still think it's a great film.
What?
I know. Hold your horses. I still love it to pieces. I still think it's as fun as such a melancholy film can be. I think it really does a good job of striking that balance that I think too many comic book films aren't good at maintaining, of being both fun and kind of having that brooding, contemplative nature. I think that's something that The Crow does very well. There's just some aspects for this film that I didn't notice before that I was like, oh, that's odd. Like the VO from Sarah, kind of little codas. Feels like a studio note. Like, it's information that we really didn't need to be told. These are things that we would have figured out.
You're just not a voiceover fan, are you?
I really like voiceover. As you'll recall, I really liked the voiceover in God Bless America. You weren't here, though.
No.
No, I like a good voiceover. It's just, I guess I don't like kids doing voiceover. Because, I don't know, it's not an easy thing to do. And the other thing that I noticed I hadn't noticed before was really kind of a poor lack of characterization honestly. And it's okay. I mean, you know, this film isn't about that. This film is about other things.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we have a very nondescriptly evil street gang who's all white, except for Tintin, to avoid any other, any weird, you know, racial issues, which I think is a good idea. You're killing an entire gang of people. It's probably best for them to be honkies. It's less controversial. I think it works out. I'm not being sarcastic. I'm being completely,
sure,
you know, serious here. I think it makes things work a little bit better.
In terms of people.
I mean, there's some moral ambiguity going on here regardless, but I think it makes it a little bit more palatable, or at least less problematic. But those were things like that. This film's still great, still stands out. It breaks your heart to watch this movie from start to finish. It really does. I mean, as fun as it is at times, and it really is, your heart hurts for what could have been,
mm-hmm.
and your heart hurts for what happened. And for those of you who are unaware, I'm sure most of you, probably all of you listening, are, Brandon Lee tragically died in an accident on the set involving a firearm that was not properly handled. The details of the incident are readily available if you have any more interest in that. But, you know, it really is a great film, and I think we might talk a little bit more later about how his tragic death and I think a really great career that could have mm-hmm. been. I think that's what makes this film, other than Alex Proyas' really unique visual style, is Brandon Lee's performance. It's really something here. And it makes your heart hurt because there are a few two actors that are skilled at doing their own action scenes that are also good actors.
Right.
And he is a good actor in this movie. Mm-hmm. I mean, he really is a good performance. Sure, he's a fight choreographer on this.
Yeah.
It's awesome. The one last tidbit I'll throw out there, obviously this is a thumbs up for me, though. If you ever get a chance to get your hands on the Collector's Edition DVD, I recommend it. Because on there is a work print cut of the office, the boardroom fight scene. It's about 2 or 3 minutes longer and way awesomer.
Mm.
It's so cool. I don't know. They cut a lot out of that fight scene. Oh my gosh. I guess they decided to go easy on the violence after the tragedy. But,
I think the ratings board had something to do with it, too.
It's my understanding that was a little bit of it, too. But I think it was also just a decision on Alex Proyas' part to go ahead and make some cuts. I don't think it was all, because it's not that much more graphic than anything else that happens in the film. But man, have you ever seen it?
It's
awesome.
Yeah, it is.
Oh my gosh. But that's it. I'm done.
Yeah. Obviously, I like this movie too. I was just getting into my teenage years when this was released, and so it very much spoke to who I am and who I was, and I was angsty and I was angry, and I needed to feel empowered, and Brandon Lee had all that going. So there was that. And then later, as I've grown up, I've fallen more in love with the film, probably, because the soundtrack, of course, is the soundtrack of my life, because everyone's life soundtrack is what they listen to in high school.
Yeah,
and so
pretty much.
That stuff is what I listen to. And so that's all excellent. The style, we're going to talk a lot about the style, is fantastic. It holds up so well. As mm-hmm. Arthur mentioned, it's paced incredibly. Every performance is fantastic. Ernie Hudson, Michael Wincott, we'll say their names over and over and over again.
Appropriately
tonight.
Over the top.
Perfect, perfect, perfect stuff. All the character actors who are playing the villains are doing a fine job. It's just, it is really, really well done. It's a really well-written comic book movie.
Yeah.
Which is sometimes rare, because usually they become a mess, and there's studio intervention and all that junk that goes along
with it. Well, especially
when
you're condensing a standalone comic book as opposed to an adaptation like, Spider-Man or something like that, where you have all these years of history to draw and you can just kind of do your own thing.
Mm-hmm.
But something like The Crow, it's a very condensed, it's a one-shot story.
Right.
And it's a very long story, so you have to kind of work around that and condense into a two-hour film. And I think they do a great job here.
And it was helped as a result, I think. Absolutely love it. Some early CGI, some early projection effects, some early use of bigatures and miniatures.
Yes,
and,
some very good use of miniatures and bigatures.
And it's just really, really fantastic. And so
bigatures.
Big miniatures.
Yeah, no, I got it. I think they're just called models at that point.
Well, Peter Jackson calls them bigatures.
Is that what he calls?
Yeah, yeah.
That's funny. I've never heard that before.
Yeah,
they really...
The Tower of Baradur is a bigature. It's like 8 feet tall.
There's some very cool use of practical effects here to really make
mm-hmm.
make the kind of gothic setting really, really oppressive and yet inviting at the same time.
And it absolutely sets off a countercultural movement. I mean, the goth scene is...
Oh, this is the movie that helped pop... I mean, again, I was four, but looking back, I think it's pretty clear to see goth really kicked off right around 95, and I think in no small part...
Well, the goth resurgence, I think it's fair to say, but right. Fair.
I think it certainly brought to a middle America, at the very least, mm-hmm. and really gave, other than, you know, the music of this film, you know, Nine Inch Nails is on the soundtrack, and, you know, The Cure. I think this film helped, oh, hey, this is something cool that can be our thing. So, and then Hot Topic took it and ran with it.
Yeah, and then there was that.
So, Hot Topic still sells crow shirts. There was Hot I'm Topic. Not kidding.
I don't doubt it. So, I like the movie also. Let's do some analysis now. Let's
get it going.
Talk about what it means. Arthur Gordon, I go to you first.
Well, before we do some analysis, can I ask you, who's your favorite gang member?
My favorite gang member would have to be Tintin, even though he died first.
He is pretty cool.
Yeah.
I mean, you're asking me to pick my favorite of a group of murdering rapists, but if I had to...
well, I'd pick Top Dollar, I guess.
Yeah.
Michael Wincott's
Michael
Top
Wincott,
Dollar.
Yeah.
He's got some style.
He's got style.
Also, Coke.
He's banging his sister.
That's not so cool.
Yeah. Half-sister?
Half-sister.
I
which
hope.
Is still...
Bai Ling. It was Bai Ling.
Mm-hmm.
Did not recognize her. She hadn't started doing Coke yet, I guess. Yeah, she's a strange one. I'm going to go with a... What do you do with T-Bird?
Yeah?
Yeah. Bash the Devil Stood.
He feels how awful goodness is.
Yeah. Holy crap. Man. That's a really great performance from that scene in the car.
Mm-hmm.
That actor, he's one of those guys. He mm-hmm. really gets to do some good work in that scene.
Cool.
And yours?
Yes.
You got asked a question, you must now answer.
I think I'd go with Tintin or T-Bird.
Yeah. Good call on Top Dollar, though.
How'd you call for Skank?
Really?
No.
Skank. Skank's ain't here. I Skank. Skank's over there.
Skank's in.
Kyle, all right, friend of the show, Kyle Davison, took to saying that a lot when we were in high school.
Well, thank you for that great additional question, Arthur. Do you have an analysis you want to bring now?
I do. I'm going to talk a little bit about cult cinema.
Yes.
It's definitely a cult film.
And that's really one of the things that stood out. I didn't really... You know, focus too much on the comic elements coming into this.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to focus on it being a cult film because it's one of the quintessential cult films, I believe, of our time.
Certainly mm-hmm. the last 20 years.
Yeah. So I was doing some research and looked at an essay by Justin Smith about British cult cinema.
Mm-hmm.
And in it, he outlined some markers of cult film. And there are about four or five main ones. That being textual characteristics of excess and incongruity. And usually these are going to have to do with violence or breaking taboos. The visual style and the music.
Mm-hmm.
Unsettling locations. And few cult films will descend into anarchy. They have to have rules. There have to be rules in place, even if there seems to be anarchy.
Chaos. Anarchy. Now that's fun!
So, we're going for textual characteristics of excess and incongruity. We see an excess of chaos and crime. The film opens on Devil's Night. There have been... 100 to 140 arson cases.
By the way, Devil's Night's a real thing.
The night before Halloween.
Horrifying.
I assume things go crazy in Detroit or wherever.
Detroit, man.
Detroit. Rest in peace. Then we have an excess of drug use. Top Dollar has a mountain of coke on his table.
He does have a mountain.
He's got himself a Tony Montana pile.
It is an absurd amount of cocaine.
What is it he says right before he does a line upon learning Tintin's dead?
Let's have a moment of silence.
Tintin.
And off he goes.
The murders, the revenge murders are done in an excessive manner.
Mm-hmm.
Tintin is stabbed in all of his vital organs in alphabetical order.
You're damn right.
And Fun Boy, I believe, takes several syringes of drugs to the heart.
Yeah, just a bunch of morphine.
A trunk
right
of dynamite for T-Bird.
Yep.
And so these are just very...
Fuses him to his steering wheel.
Yep. And Skank's just thrown out a window because who gives a shit about Skank?
Skank's over there, man.
Skank.
These could have been some, you know, smaller scale murders.
Yeah.
You know? They all could have resembled Skanks, but a lot of them were bigger. And the violence, it actually becomes more excessive as we progress to the end of the film.
Oh, for sure.
Go back and forth here. The visual style of music, you know, this visual, critically praised visual style, which is allowed to take center stage as the actors are not, you know, well-known. They're not big names that take away from what the director is able to do. He's able to craft a style and show you things and let us not get distracted by who's who in this.
Although I think that that might not apply in this case. If only because of what happened before the film was released and finished.
Oh, sure.
I think that really... I think that only adds to it. I think in some cases a big name or a at least up-and-coming name can really add to a cult film's popularity.
Yeah.
But, I mean, yeah, this is definitely adheres to all of these. Sorry.
This also allows the acting and performances to come off in a different light as it removes expectations.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the smaller characters and the side stuff.
Yeah.
The movie featured a strong soundtrack of alt rock and focused on a character who was the lead singer of a band.
Mm-hmm.
And a visual flair that echoes Ridley Scott's Blade Runner and the early works of Tim Burton, the sure. Batman films of Beetlejuice at that point. Unsettling locations, obviously, as soon as we open this fairy tale opening over Detroit and on Devil's Night, we see this hellish vision of Detroit.
Mm.
Flames coming up through all the I'm assuming that was the miniatures set as they're coming in. Then we have the pit, the apartment, Top Dollar's place. They're all exaggerated. They're all more intense than they realistically
over
could be. Gritty, over the top.
One critic said when this first came out that Alex Proyas made Detroit. Alex Proyas' Detroit made Gotham City look like the Emerald City.
Yeah.
That's fair.
The other thing is the perpetual rain that begins with Eric's resurrection is there, and it's just part of that backdrop to add to the city. And the anarchy. It would appear that anarchy reigns, especially on the opening here, but we find out our criminals act out of certain traditions and rules. This is Devil's Night. This is the night that they do these crazy things. The villains are killed, but they're all killed in the order by which they partake in the rape. And this is so. This is another rule that the perceived anarchy lives by. And also, I would like to point out props to costume design for putting a slit down the back of Eric's burial suit when he climbs out of the pit. It's been cut open down the back.
Oh my gosh! You're right. Which is a thing that is actually done.
Yeah. Yep. Most time you see zombies or something get out of the graves, their suits are fully intact. Yeah. So,
Go. Fun fact, in case you've ever wondered, when they bury you, they you don't actually dress you. They cut your suit or dress or whatever down the back and
tuck it around you.
Yep. The more you know.
The more you know. Dalton?
Dalton Stewart, yes. What do you bring to the table?
Well, I thought about it for a little bit because, as you know, I do try to approach our films with kind of a look at it. Their social implications. And that's usually what I try to do. And this film, on the surface, doesn't really seem like there's a lot going on. It's a pretty standard revenge thriller. But the more you think about it, the more you realize there is a lot going on in this film. Particularly things, we look at like urban decay. This idea that a large metropolis just cannot, it's not a self-sustaining system. That eventually it just kind of implodes upon itself. Obviously we have, you know, the nature of revenge and violence and the justification. The justifiability. I don't like making words up. You know, how when is violence okay? And when is vengeance okay? And I think here is the most, you know, here is the most movieified representation of violence as a course of action you'll ever see. The people who are having the vengeance taken out against them are pure evil. They have no redeeming qualities. They're drug addicts. They are rapists. They are murderers. They are overall abhorrent people. And that kind of allows, and again, as I mentioned earlier, they are largely monochromatic, which allows you, the majority viewer, to remove any compunctions they would have about these people meeting a gruesome end. But also there is this idea of how important one person can be. You know, this very American idea of one person being standing above the masses in defense of something. Shelley is murdered because she tries to organize a a petition against their removal from their tenement. It's kind of vague what's going on. But for
they're that, they're clearing it out.
They're clearing out for land development because
urban renewal.
Not only is Top Dollar a psychopath Joker type, he's also a Lex Luthor type. They're clearing the place out. Mm-hmm. And her, she organizes a petition for which she is brutally murdered, and by coincidence, so is Eric. And that's what happens when we try to take the nonviolent, organized approach to standing up to oppression, but paint your face up, put on a duster, and grab your guns and kick some ass, and problem solved.
Everybody dies.
Now, I'm not, yeah, and again, I don't think this film is trying to say that at all. I just think it's important we always keep in mind there's a difference between film and real life.
Mm-hmm.
I think stories of violence and catharsis are very important. And I think it's a good way to process grief. Jim O'Barr, James O'Barr, rather, who wrote the comic book this film is based on, wrote a comic to deal with the death of his girlfriend who was killed in a drunk driving accident. So, I mean, I clearly, violence as catharsis is a very real thing. I think this is a film that can kind of speaks to that deeply. The last thing I thought about while watching this, and it's kind of hard not to, is this this dialectic, this back and forth that exists between real life and art. That I think's very interesting. Brandon Lee's father, Bruce Lee, died on the set of a movie. Brandon Lee also died on the set of a movie, although much less of Bruce Lee's, although his death still kind of nobody's really sure quite what happened. It's believed to be natural causes. Brandon was killed in a very tragic accident, and this is a really interesting way in which life imitates art and art imitates life.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, James O'Barr set out to help himself process the death of his girlfriend and the filming of the film version of his story. Someone was killed, and that completely changed the way films dealt with firearms on set. It's kind of interesting back and forth. But that's what I bring to the table for you this week, gentlemen.
I think it's interesting, you know, this idea of economic decay and, mm-hmm. you know, the forces at play and how they take advantage of the lives of those in those apartments,
yes.
you know, and kind of move them around, especially in lieu of, and I mentioned this before we went on air, the events of this week.
Yes.
The city of Detroit has declared bankruptcy just this very week. We're seeing exactly the same sort of things being taken place so that, and the bankruptcy move is, among other things, a way to avoid paying pensions to police officers, firemen, and other city workers.
Which is another thing touched upon in countless films, but also this one, is the bureaucracy of police work.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's only one good cop in all
there's
Detroit.
There's only one good cop in all Detroit, in all of any city. There's only, there is yay, but one cop who stands alone. But yeah. Also, just occurred to me, while literally apropos of nothing, the importance of parental figures in this film.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
the mother's the name for God, the lips of all children.
The lips and hearts of all children, yeah. I mean, the importance of having someone to shepherd the young and show them the ways, I mean, it's very, I mean, it's
pretty crucial.
Yeah, very crucial, and I for some reason it didn't occur to me just now, the importance thereof in this film. I mean, Sarah literally has four parental figures in this film, between Ernie Hudson, Eric, and, oh my gosh, Shelley, and her own mother.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's
Darla.
Morphine is bad for you.
Mm-hmm. It is. Well, that's great analysis, Dalton. I'm going to talk about something that I'm very interested in, and it's part of the research I do, and perhaps something I might write someday if I ever can get motivated. But I digress there. And that
yeah, nobody wants to hear about your writer's block.
The visual style of the movie itself. Because everyone says, striking visual style. And that just means it looks neat. And you know,
doesn't say anything.
It doesn't really. You know, Netflix, as that is kind of our standard platform that we're using for our selection of films for the Good Trash Genre Cast,
mm-hmm.
Oftentimes suggests to me visually striking
mm-hmm.
films.
I get visually striking violent films a lot.
Right?
Yeah.
And they are of greater and lesser
quality
all along the spectrum. And so what are we talking about? We're talking about visual style. And, you know, then that really just, it's about color palette, it's about architecture, it's about set design, it's about set dressing, it's about a whole lot of things. The Crow, as a film, we've talked about the goth movement, and surprisingly enough, or not so much, the overall visual style is gothicism.
Mm, for sure.
And the narrative structure of the film follows a gothic romance.
Yeah, I was going to say, important to note, we're not talking goth here as in, you know, Nine Inch Nails and black fingernail polish. We're talking gothicism.
Gothicism.
I mean, we're talking 1800s goth.
It's
a very different brand.
Yeah, we're definitely talking 17th century stuff is what we're talking. And we're talking stuff that is old churches, gargoyles, etc.
Don't fall in a gargoyle, man.
Or don't do it. It'll be ugly. Ornate crosses and all. And then, of course, those things are going on. The palette is very, very black. It also follows quite a bit of what we call German Expressionism with the strange angles and, again, the use of very, very dark palette. and there's kind of a desaturation even of the regular color scenes. It's funny to me. I watched the movie, and it almost feels black and white at points.
Well, he actually
just during Crowvision.
No, Alex Proyas wanted to shoot it in black and white.
He considered it, I understand. Yeah.
They wouldn't let him.
And that is okay.
It's kind of a cheat, honestly.
But even the color scenes, it just feel like somehow something has been
less colorful,
drained of it, right?
Well, it kind of adds the sense of an unlife in a lot of ways. Yeah, this kind of half-life, this half-existence, you know.
And, of course, tropes of gothic romance novels of the 19th century, you know, Castle of Otranto, which is just almost in the 19th century, 18th century, Dracula, Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. Mm-hmm. And other films of that sort. There's all of that sort of gothic romance. There's a supernatural intervention. I thought of Dracula when he comes up out of the grave. I mean, it feels very much like a Dracula type resurrection. His very night walking sort of behavior. So all of that's going on inside this film. That's very gothic, very German expressionist, which is probably something people have talked about a ton. But
oh, sure.
What I want to talk about, and I know this is a long introduction to get to where I want to go, is the use of surrealism in this film. Major tropes. I know, right?
Okay, keep talking.
Major tropes of surrealism. The first and foremost of those, the great surrealist film is Un Chien Andalou, which is Louis Buñuel's 15-minute short, co-directed with Salvador Dali and all of his crazy mustachios. And it is opens with this razor blade eyeball cut, right? The violence against eyes. Mm. You ever notice there's a lot of violence against eyes in this movie?
Mm-hmm.
I'm just saying. They cut the girl's pretty eyes out. Of course, the crow cuts her eyes out. Then there's the vestibule open window of the loft, which is shaped like an eye, out of which Eric Draven is thrown. When he jumps through the window of said
eye.
His hands are slit just like a razor. He's also slit by the same sort of cutthroat razor by Darla when he is trying to bring her out of her morphine stupor. All of these things tie very greatly to this idea of surrealism and just those sort of visual motifs. But beyond that, Nine Inch Nails does a song on the soundtrack.
They do.
They do a Joy Division song called Dead Souls. It was asked that they would do that. And the line in the song is talking about chasing these dreams away, getting away from reality, entering into some sort of subconscious understanding of one's past, which is, again, major Freudian influences of what surrealism is all about. There's a whole lot of surrealism going on in Alex Proyas's visual style as well as that. He is a brilliant director. He's able to use tons of visual styles.
Oh, sure.
More so than just very dark, very gothic, very gritty, you know, references to film noir, German expressionism, yada, yada, yada. He's mixing a whole lot more stuff in that bag than just that. And that romantic, that gothic romance is where he takes his surrealist turn. And that's pretty amazing to me and interesting to me, and I found it to be just a lot of fun to see that in the film, and I was even more blown away as I watched Knowing this week, which is another Alex Proyas film, of which Dalton Stewart makes a stink face.
Just, I've never had any urge.
However, the young boy's room has the same window and arch supports, and when he has his vision, he looks out the window, he sees a whole bunch of animals on fire running out, which is what Salvador Dali does in several of his paintings. There's some giraffes on fire. And I thought, surrealism, it's all over Mr. Proyas. And I found that to be pretty fascinating. So, you want to do some intertextuality? Yeah, fine. Look at the novel, fine. Look at film noir, that's great. Other Proyas stuff. But you got to look at some surrealist film and art, because I think it's got something to say
for sure
about this film called The Crow. So that's the analysis that I bring.
I dig it.
Alrighty, guys. Well, let's do what we do. Shelf or trash, else or instead. I begin to my left. Mr. Dalton Stewart.
Oh, shelf. I mean, shocker, I know. This is a perennial favorite. I mean, this never ceases to be fun to watch. I mean, as bleak as this film is, and as bleak as the real-life events that I think make this film so, I mean, even more interesting than it is on its own merit, it's also it's just a good damn movie.
Yeah, it is.
It really is. It works on a lot of levels. You know, for a film that is billed as an action film most of the time, really a very kind of slow and I mean, the pacing is entertaining, but it's a very ponderous film. It's a very melancholy, obviously, film. I mean, subject matter and goth influences, you know, you can't deny it. It just works on a lot of levels, though. It really does. Else, I would recommend you check out Alex Proyas' second major studio film, 1998's Dark City.
Mm-hmm.
Part of this weird spate of films leading up to and just after The Matrix that all had to deal with some sort of secondary existence or secondary reality. This film, Dark City, followed by Existence, however the hell you want to say it, by Mr. Cronenberg. and then the 13th floor, and then The Matrix. All these films being developed at the same time. It's really this weird thing. I don't know, everybody was like smoking pot at the same hangouts or whatever. I mean, because these films are all released in such a tight time span that they really could have influenced each other that much. But Dark City, I think, other than The Matrix, is probably the best made and probably one of the most entertaining and most important of those, that kind of spate of alternate reality films. It's also got a lot of surrealistic and neo-noir influences. Mm-hmm. Stars Rufus Sewell. No, he's British. He's in The Knight's Tale. You know what I'm talking about. An actor who is much undervalued, probably because he has a difficult-to-pronounce last name. But
And one weird eye.
And one weird eye, he does. He's a good-looking man, though, for that lazy eye. It's a good flick, though. I'd check it out. I really like Dark City a lot.
Excellent. I like that pick, Mr. Dalton Stewart. Mr. Arthur Gordon, Shelf or Trash, Elsewhere Instead.
Shelf.
Oh, really?
Oh, shocker.
Huh.
Call the presses. Shelf. It's going.
X-ray, X-ray. Read all about it. Arthur Gordon of Good Trash Genre Cast Shelves the Crow.
I'll be here all week.
It's quite a newsy voice you had there, Arthur.
Or instead.
If we probably get into this discussion at some point. Watch this film with The Dark Knight and The Imaginarium and Dr. Parnassus.
Okay. Yeah.
I'm telling you what.
I get what you're saying.
Brandon Lee could have played the Joker villain.
Oh, yeah.
As good. I am that impressed with his performance. I think that's totally fair.
Yeah, I'd say it's fair. I mean, he does a lot of quality acting behind that makeup.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I definitely in terms of tragic losses, I think certainly that makes sense.
Outstanding. Well, thank you, Mr. Arthur Gordon. I'm obviously going to say Shelf as well. In fact, it is on my shelf in both DVD and Blu-ray. Because yeah,
has Blu-ray got anything good on there?
It's got Alex Proyas commentary. So yeah, it's fantastic and it's totally worth seeing, and I recommend it highly. What else should
you not see? Have you not seen this movie? Stop. Go. It's on Netflix. What are you doing? Come back.
I'll watch the movie.
Seriously.
So what else would I recommend? As far as using gothic romance in a sort of different sort of setting and doing something fun with it, I would recommend Guillermo del Toro's The Devil's Backbone, which is totally a gothic romance and set in a Spanish setting in the Spanish Civil War. And also just to talk about an action film that has this great visual style that elevates the work itself, the obvious pick to me is Drive. I think side by side with Drive, we're looking at something that's just an art version of a basic kind of popcorn genre flick.
I'd say that's a very fair... That'd be a hell of a double feature, actually.
Man, it'd be a good day.
Yeah.
I'm just saying. So those would be
violent retribution for the love of... A man living a half existence seeks violent retribution in defense of his lost love. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it's pretty.
And it's hell... Oh, my gosh. Two... I mean, you couldn't think of more two opposite sides of the same very stark visual coin.
Well, we're going to go move on now to our game. If you'd like to have some feedback and let us know what you thought of The Crow and what you thought of our analysis and or reviews of the film, you can do that on Facebook. Where is that at, Mr. Arthur Gordon?
You can find that at www.facebook.com/goodtrashgenrecast. One word.
Thank you, Arthur. Dalton, why don't you go ahead and introduce our game and discussion for tonight, and we'll move on into that.
Well, tonight we're going to be talking about a little something that I can't believe it hasn't come up on the show before, actually, and that's comic book films, believe it or not. But we decided it was a little too broad, especially for a film that is so specific to a certain tone and visual style. So more specifically, we're going to be looking at this the dark comic, the adult comic. And I say comic because, honestly, I think the term graphic novel is bullshit. Don't tell anybody. It's that part of that 90s thing of trying to make itself seem self-important.
Trying to elevate the...
Yeah, and it's fallen out of favor. You don't really hear a lot of people use that term anymore because it's six in one hand, half a dozen the other, right, honestly. But that's what we're going to be looking at, is this idea of the dark comic book film. You know, we're not necessarily looking at fidelity to the source material, but just taking the tropes of the comic book genre and really putting a more mature and more nuanced spin on it, I guess. So, Arthur, why don't you kick us off?
Okay. I don't know why I paused so long there.
That was
sorry.
Scary.
I
thought
apologize.
You were having a stroke or something. Was, you okay?
I'm good.
All right.
I'm good. Anyway, okay. To kick it off, I'm going to talk about Mr. Cronenberg's two films, The History of Violence and Eastern Promises.
Yeah, but...
Which I think are very
is
good.
Is Eastern Promises a comic?
No.
Is it not?
No, it's just very much a companion film of sorts to a History
well,
of Violence.
Okay.
Skip Eastern Promises and just focus on History of Violence, then, which is a phenomenal movie.
Oh, my word, yes.
Fantastic.
Garnered Academy Award praise, I believe. At the
a nomination
Oscar praise.
Yeah, I think so.
Nominations.
So it's great performances from Viggo. Starts one way and it goes a completely different direction, not very far in.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a wonderful film. I'm going to move on.
And that you know what's interesting about that before you move on, Arthur? Is how it is dark without the palette.
Yeah.
You know, it,
the tone.
It is a very bright sort of palette. Now,
yeah.
Either of you read the comic? Is the comic black and
I
white?
I have not. I've flipped through it, and as I recall, it is black and white. Yeah.
So I find that to be interesting, because,
yeah.
You know, The Crow was a black and white comic
yes.
book, so that color palette makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Cronenberg takes this completely different decision, and the darkness remains.
Yeah.
I find that...
It's dark, yet colorful.
Because at first... Probably, 45 minutes of the movie when we're meeting Mortensen's character.
It's very
it's the all-American family.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The Midwest.
It's Indiana.
I think about that set that the end of the first act, it kind of takes, it's still colorful, yet everything feels overcast. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, that's the first one on my list. The next one, we're talking about a movie I really enjoy. It's the first DVD I actually ever bought.
Oh.
It's From Hell by the Hughes Brothers.
Oh,
starring
yeah.
Johnny Depp
oh, wow.
and Graham.
I've actually never seen that
about the
one.
Jack the Ripper murders.
Yeah.
Depp's the investigator lead on that. I like those kind of movies. I like Johnny Depp. And I just think it's a really fun movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's just one of those personal things I like. But I was thinking, what's one really good, dark movie based on a comic?
Mm.
And I was trying to think of one that stuck with me that's so good. And it's Road to Perdition.
Oh, goodness.
Which
yeah.
I think is a brilliant film. Tom Hanks, Paul Newman. The list goes with Jude Law, I believe. The list kind of just goes on with that cast. I believe there's some revenge in there. It's been a while since I've seen it, but I remember it stuck with me.
Yeah, that's a heck of a film.
Yeah. So those are my highlights for you guys.
Good picks, man.
Outstanding. Well, Mr. L. Stewart, what do you bring?
Well, you know, I really went with the greatest hits here. I kind of thought about some of the great ones, and I'm not talking about the films themselves, but really the comics themselves, and then the films in turn. One that I went to almost immediately is Sin City, which I think is really a heck of a companion film for The Crow. I think without The Crow, you don't get Sin City.
Mm-hmm.
And Sin City is a film that the more I watch, the less I like it, but I still think it's a very strong film, visually speaking, and really
it sure is.
Really plays to noir tropes in a very skillful manner. I think the more I've watched, the more I start to have problems with the characterization and the story and... The representation of females, but
Frank Miller
just basically being a fascist. But really, it's still a heck of a fine film, and I really enjoy it. But you know, I was thinking about films that really capture what can elevate comic books as an art form. And as much as I think he's a weirdo, you got to go to Alan Moore, and I went with V for Vendetta, which
oh, good call.
I think is a fine film. Yeah. And really, yeah, in a lot of ways, a companion of sorts to The Crow in that it was sold as an action film, and yet features maybe an action set piece, surrounded by a lot of really interesting character development. And you want to talk about character development, V for Vendetta's got it in spades, man.
Mm-hmm.
It really does. That's a film that shines through. I mean, much is made of the political discussions in that film. And I don't
as
think,
it should be.
Well, I think they're more... I think the comic actually has a lot more interesting things going on in terms of the politics. Asks more interesting questions. The film asks a very simple question. Isn't fascism awful, and isn't it better to be free? And of course it is, but the book asks a more interesting question. Is anarchy better than fascism? Is absolute freedom better than absolute order? And so the comic asks some very, very striking, asks the reader to really consider some very weighty issues. But what the film brings is that visual style that, I mean, comic books have had over, I think, a lot of other storytelling mediums for years. For years and years and years. It has a very kind of, the colors are very, this is the mid-80s, this is before, you know, the kind of computer printing revolution that you see in comic books now. It's very, everything's very glossy. This is still when comics are very pulpy. And the colors are very vivid and yet very washed out because it's still four-color printing.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a, and that translates so well to the film version, kind of in the way that A History of Violence does, in that it is very colorful and yet very dark and oppressive at the same time. But the other thing that the film does very well that I think is just speaks a lot to it is the characterization of... oh my goodness, Natalie Portman's character, Evie, I believe is her name in the film.
I remember her character name
that was saved my life, but she has a really interesting character growth to me. Some have made less of it than I think is fair. I think it's a very interesting character growth. And also, of course, Hugo Weaving is masterful. I would say masterwork performance as V, and really a very interesting character and really a hell of a performance. So that is a film that I think really stands as kind of one of the go-to icons for this kind of film.
Outstanding. Well, my dark comic book adaptations, I'll begin with my, I don't know, least influential and go to my most. Least influential, but perhaps will have continuing future influence, is 30 Days of Night.
Oh, man.
Is a great movie. I actually got it on loan from Dalton Stewart not very long ago. And
the books. Yeah, that's right. I love those to you.
And, man, I tell you what, that is fantastic. Fantastic film in its exercise of style. Mm-hmm. And you know, the darkness of the subject matter and
bleak,
just, huh?
Bleak.
Ooh, yeah. And the action is really, really well paced. And the conclusion, man, I believed it.
Yeah,
I believed it, and it was really wonderful. And it's vampires the way I like them, which is awful, grotesque. You know,
great white sharks, man.
Yeah, and I really, really enjoyed the movie, and I think that's a great dark comic adaptation.
Can we talk about the weird second act break that actually makes the film even bleaker, where it basically turns into a Holocaust film?
Yes.
For about 15, 20 minutes.
While they're hiding up in the roof?
They hide in the attic for like 10, 15 minutes, yeah, and that's all. There's the basement.
It's an attic, I believe.
It's an attic, yeah. It's just like, oh my goodness.
With the dude from Sons of Anarchy.
Oh, yeah. Man.
But my second film that I want to talk about... you talked about how you wouldn't have Sin City if you wouldn't have The Crow. We wouldn't have The Crow if we didn't have Tim Burton's Batman.
Oh, for sure.
I mean, and that is, it was going that dark direction. Now, you have to remember what comic book movies were before that.
Bad.
They were Wes Craven's Swamp Thing. They were the Richard Donner Superman films.
I think those are gloriously overrated. I really do.
I don't love them. I have no love for them at all.
And in fairness, the second one, he got stolen from him, but...
Well, Richard Lester was on that, and I have a soft spot for him. Hard Day's Night, what can I say?
Gloriously overrated films.
But, you know, that movie took a comic book story and made it really, really dark and gothic. And, I mean, it's Gotham City, for crying out loud. Generally, it was adapting the Killing Joke. And I really enjoy that movie a whole lot. And it really kind of... began a real revolution, I think, in darkening the films. If you look at the palette of films before 1989, just major Hollywood mainstream releases, and it's pretty sunny.
Yeah.
It's really pretty sunny. Full light, flat light, and something happened with style, and we have to thank Tim Burton for it to have happened.
I guess.
You know, I mean, as far as commercial cinema.
Yeah, no,
I mean,
right.
Just showing that you can do that and make money.
Yeah.
And now I'm certain that if we, you know, by saying what I've just said, the dear listener will say, there are movies before that that were just that way that did make money. Of course, Blade Runner made some money.
Did all right.
But it didn't, it wasn't the hit.
It wasn't a cash cow, yeah, for sure.
But it definitely used a very, very striking style as well. But I'm thinking just other, you know.
In terms of, yeah, no, I get exactly what you're saying. In terms of proving that gothicism and darkness were marketable.
Right. There are other dark films that made a lot of money. The first Terminator film made that money. But it's dark in that it often was shot at nighttime.
Yeah.
Which is not the same thing as being a dark film, right?
Very different.
And so it's a different animal than that. The actual use of the camera and of the lighting to create this sort of oppressive atmosphere. When they say atmospheric filmmaking, that's kind of what we're talking about. Batman, the 1989 version, Tim Burton, Michael Keaton, the amazing Jack Nicholson as a Joker.
The impenetrable, the impeccable, the infanticidal, other M words. Man, he's
crazy.
Forever a golden god.
Yeah, I like Jack Nicholson a lot and pretty much anything. And Jack Palance!
Oh my goodness, you're right.
Right? Mm-hmm. I'm just saying. Yeah,
I forgot about that.
And that's pretty wonderful anyway. And Billy D. Williams as Harvey Dent.
Billy D! Sorry.
That's just good stuff all by itself. I love that movie. I want to know where does he get those wonderful toys myself. And it's endlessly quotable in my house. Again, we are Sons of the Bad. So that is my recommendation. For that. What are your recommendations, dear listener?
Do tell us.
What do you think of when you think of a good dark comic adaptation that you would recommend to us and all the other minion and millions and numerous listeners, multitudinous listeners of the Good Trash Genrecast? Please let us all know that.
Our ranks swell to nigh infinite numbers.
Maybe via another medium of social media. What would that be, Mr. Stewart?
That social medium is the name for God on the hearts and lips of self-centered people everywhere. That is Twitter, my dear friends. You can find the Good Trash Genrecast on Twitter at good_trash.
Excellent, excellent.
And we actually did have a bit of, well, not really feedback, so much as an interesting article this week on the Twitter. Brigham Cole, as you know, frequent contributor to all things Good Trash, sent us an interesting story that I skimmed through that I recommend you check out. I'll retweet it for you. But it is an article, I forget from what website, basically a posting of some ideas of Steven Spielberg of that the movie industry is basically due for a complete financial meltdown, similar to the one it experienced right when he had his start in filmmaking. So it's definitely something you should check out. Kind of talks about the... we talked about insustainability and urban decay, you know, when we're, I was discussing my analysis with Crow, kind of talking about the insustainability of the current blockbuster model and the current big-budget filmmaking and how, you know, money is lost. You got to remember, even movies that, quote, make money, don't make that much sometimes. I mean, you hear $50 million and you think, oh my goodness, what an unfathomable amount of money. And yeah, I agree with you, but in terms of the studio system, we're talking... pennies.
Yeah, I tell you what, the old-fashioned studio system, for all that it was wrong about it and how the management of the lives of stars, they churned out a whole lot of movies, and they were pretty good.
Well, they had some stinkers, too.
They had some stinkers in there, but they had this bill where they were making lots of them, and that's how they were able to turn a profit.
Yeah, that's true.
And I think something more like that, where they began to tell more personal stories, more come up with new genres. I mean, I don't want to see... necessarily the old genres coming back. I don't need two Westerns a week coming out again. But, no, we don't.
No. At least one a month would be nice.
One a month would be nice. So maybe revamp that particular genre.
That's, you know, this is another conversation for another day. That's the thing that pisses me off most about Lone Ranger tanking, is the only thing that they will learn from this is that nobody wants to see cowboy movies.
And that's not right.
You know that's the only thing they'll learn from this, though.
Yeah.
And that's a mistake. And that's the problem with the studio system, is they think that they can, you know, they think everything is a science. And yeah, when you can predict an election, you know, the way we've seen it done before to almost the letter, yeah, everything can be punched into a magical number formula. Unfortunately, they haven't figured out the number formula yet for film.
Mm-hmm.
Does it exist? Probably. Well, you haven't figured it out yet. Maybe actually take some risks. damn it. And I can't take full credit for that analogy. I picked that up from a video I watched at Movie Bob on The Escapist a couple weeks ago, talking about the disaster that was Lone Ranger. But, I mean, yeah, that's the only thing we'll take away from this. He's absolutely right. Anyway, that's another rant for another day. Sorry, don't want to get off on a tangent here.
Outstanding. Well, thank you for that listener feedback, and dear listener, by all means, give us feedback. We would love to keep the conversation
going. Strap
that
feedback on, baby.
It can be done at the actual Podbean site. It can be done at Twitter, as you've heard, also at the Facebook. And we want to keep this
going.
Heck,
it can be done on iTunes, too, if you're feeling froggy.
Yeah, you know, it could happen. It could indeed. So, let's move on to what we do every week, which is talk about what's got us fired up this week in pop culture. I begin to my left, Mr. Dalton Stewart. Are you fired up?
I am, indeed. About a thing or two or 12. First of all, I wanted to wait till Arthur got back from his little vacation. I forgot last week. I watched Luther on his advice, and man, that's a good show. I liked it a lot. Moving on quickly, though, I want to talk about what consumed most of my week in pop culture, and that was a game that came out 3 years ago that I just started playing, and that's Civilization V. Oh my god, it's eating my life. It is by far probably one of the most addictive things I've ever partaken in, and it's just a bucket of gravy. It's so much fun. Oh my goodness. Strategy and politics and resource management and all of the wonderful things. Ugh. If you haven't played a Civilization game before, you're missing out, especially if you haven't played Civ 5. I have not yet got the new expansion, but man, that's literally all I've been doing this week, guys. I'm not kidding. I played for 5 hours straight one night. Straight. My back hurt from being hunched over my laptop the next morning. It was awesome.
You got a problem, man.
I know. I'm just set up boundaries for myself, which is something I'm usually not needing to do with video games. I'm usually pretty good to be like, okay, now I'm done. No, this game is like very conducive to compulsive behavior. Be wary. A lot of fun, though. I recommend you check that out if you get around to it. It's like $30. It's been out for 3 years. Secondly, I want to break a rule. Secondly, this is thirdly. I got to break
what?
A rule. I got to break a rule, guys.
The Fincher rule.
So, those of you who listen to this show occasionally might know I like a little film called Fight Club. and I really like a director by the name of David Fincher, and I got to break the rule twice. This week, Chuck Palahniuk, the author of the novel Fight Club, has announced that he's working in some regard. I don't know if it's actually a manuscript yet or just an outline, but working on a sequel to Fight Club. And I don't really know how I feel about that. Kind of a closed-ended story.
Yeah.
I mean, if you haven't read the novel, it's pretty damn similar to the film. I mean, it's a little bit more open-ended of an ending, but it's still kind of more of a, ha-ha, gotcha, open-ended. Mm-hmm. Not really a need for continuation. It's just, I don't know, man. He's got books that actually could use a sequel, like Lullaby. That's a good one. That book could use a sequel. It actually has a story that you're like, wow, now I want to go over, know where this goes now. Even Survivor, which is even more pretty closed-ended than Fight Club in some regards. I'd read a sequel to that. I want to know where that keeps going. I don't know. I'm really conflicted about that, guys. And this is coming from me, the singer of all praises for Fight Club. I my heart feels weird. I don't know. I'll probably read it, but it doesn't mean I'm less confused. Secondly, I'm breaking the rule twofold here. I'm sorry. I'm fired up, though. I assumed this was free of the rules. David Fincher has begun work on his next theatrical film. An adaptation of a novel called Gone Girl. Rosamund Pike and Ben Affleck have been cast as the two leads. The conceit of the film is a man is charged. I'm not sure if he's charged or basically the idea of the novel is a wife is murdered, and the entire kind of the dramatic tension is, did he murder her or not? We're not sure, and much of their relationship and its rocky nature is addressed in flashback, but I'm excited. You know, I like me a David Fincher film, so hopefully this is a good one.
Okay. Sounds good, Dalton. Well, we'll allow those rule violations.
I didn't violate it.
You may have to spend some time in the sin bin.
For the record, I did not violate the rule in our discussion, which I will never do again until a time is decided it's okay. It's purely for my week in pop culture.
Well, Mr. Arthur Gordon, are you fired up this week?
Actually, yeah, quite a bit, I think.
Quite a bit.
Yeah.
The first thing I want to talk about, there's a movie coming out that I'm getting pretty hyped up for because trailers are terrifying me, and it's not any of the summer or the big Halloween releases. It's actually Alfonso Cuarón's Gravity.
Yeah,
I know. Yeah,
that trailer is the most terrifying thing I've ever thought about.
Yeah.
If you're in an ocean and get stranded, you've got a good chance of being saved. But if you're in space, yeah, no, I don't.
Yeah, like, you can swim to shore. I mean, it's going to suck.
But you can try.
You can try, at least.
But in space,
you're fucked.
Where no one can hear you scream. I mean,
literally, that's it. Period.
That trailer is the movie, because they're just floating away. How can you come back from that? I need to know.
I got it. I know.
So when October gets here, I will be going to see Alfonso Cuarón's Gravity, because I'm pretty excited.
Because it's
excited
Alfonso Cuarón.
Yeah, that is the other part of it.
And it's awesome.
As writer-director.
That's been in production for a long time, and I'm finally glad to see it's about to come out.
Another upcoming movie, and I just want to get this out there, it's Christopher Nolan's next movie, Interstellar.
Interstellar, yeah.
Every time I hear a new cast addition, I get really excited.
The cast of this movie is bonkers.
Anne Hathaway, Jessica Chastain, Matthew McConaughey, Casey Affleck, Michael Caine, Topher Grace, John Lithgow.
Yeah.
What?
Amazing cast. I am so excited to see Matthew McConaughey under the direction of Christopher Nolan.
Because
McConaughey is a phenomenal actor.
Oh, man.
When he wants to be.
Yeah.
Right. There's a McConaissance going on, right?
The McConaissance, yeah.
Yeah.
It's a big deal.
So I'm getting pumped. There's a couple of sci-fi films that can be pretty good.
Here's the deal. You had me at Chastain, McConaughey, Hathaway. Literally the three prettiest people that ever lived. I'm sold.
This is a beautiful people's movie.
Seriously. Even Mike O'Kane.
And John Lithgow. That has, after watching season 4 of Dexter with Trinity, I love John Lithgow. And so I am hyped for this movie. A couple other things. The big announcement out of Comic-Con. A lot of things came out. The big one is the Man of Steel sequel, which will supposedly announced Batman
as
versus
a co-star.
Co-starring with Superman.
Yeah.
Assumingly leading up to a Justice League film down the road.
And this is following a Flash film, allegedly.
Is it?
Yeah.
I thought this was in 15 and then 16 Flash was coming out.
Oh, my mistake.
I think. I could be wrong. I haven't actually heard announcements.
I haven't followed Comic-Con this closely this year, but there's a lot coming out.
That seemed to be the biggest. So that's
Marvel basically just did what they've been doing for the last 3 years and took their shirt off and did a victory lap just around everyone else.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's what they needed. I mean, I think there was some Guardians of the Galaxy stuff, the Loki appearance at Thor.
Tom Hiddleston basically just
being awesome.
Just made the entire audience his worms and they loved it.
It was pretty fun to watch. Outside of that, last night I went out. My wife's out of town on business, so I went out. I pulled a double feature down in Tinseltown.
Dirty man.
8 o'clock, I went and saw The Conjuring, and I followed that up with the 10 o'clock showing of The Wolverine.
Go on, good sir.
The Wolverine is a great, well, I wouldn't say, you know, it's not great. That's going to be overzealous.
Yeah.
It's certainly better than Origins and Last Stand. I would maybe mark it, if I were rating all six movies, I'd tie it at third with X-Men.
With the original?
Yeah.
Wow.
I think it's a solid film. I think it's a solid outing for the character of Wolverine.
Yeah.
We get a somber, darker film that gets to explore how, I mean, he's not a happy person. You know, he wants to die, and this explores that idea of does he have something to live for?
It's the vampire story
almost. Yeah, it really is. I'm going to try and check it out before this weekend's over.
And I was unaware of this. I didn't know exactly chronologically how this, because the chronology of the X-Men has been completely screwed up since First Class.
Intentionally.
I'm all for that.
Yeah.
But, so this movie is set following Last Stand.
Yes.
Is where we are. I don't know how long after, it doesn't say.
Mm-hmm.
He's long enough to have shoulder-length hair and beard.
Right.
Regardless.
Much like yourself.
Flashbacks.
Yes. Dreams. But regardless, this is set to bridge us into Days of Future Past.
Which I'm so excited for. I could.
And this movie features maybe one of Marvel's best stingers. Well, in a Marvel film.
Technically not a Marvel Studios production.
But the stinger, it's in the credit. It's only a couple minutes in. You don't have to wait.
Oh, thank goodness.
So they do the big main credits, and then boom, here's the stinger. Phenomenal. Mm. Audience is clapping. It's maybe on par with the original Nick Fury Iron Man stinger. I think it's going to get a lot of people happy, a lot of people excited.
Are you aware of the cast of Days of Future Past?
It's
everyone.
Ever.
Everyone. That's ever been an X-Men movie, plus Peter Dinklage.
Nice.
What more do you want out of your life?
I don't know that there's going to be a lot of character or anything in Days,
but
I'm pretty hyped
up about
it. But
the fact that they're all there is awesome.
So, but the other thing, even more than The Wolverine, is The Conjuring.
Yes.
The Conjuring is probably the best horror movie of the last few years.
Really?
But I would go so far as to say it's one of, if not the best movie of the year, commercially.
Really?
It is a great movie. Smart. It's so well made. Direction is spot on, but the tone, and it's not a movie that survives just to show you jump scare after jump scare with nothing in the middle. This movie is continuously building tone, building this sense of dread, so when the scares come, they are happening, and it just gets more and more intense as the film builds along.
Wow.
I think...
Any film that the MPAA basically says, I'm sorry, we can't make this PG-13 because it's too scary.
Yeah, there's...
That's certainly one to check out.
No gore, there's hardly any cussing. It's rated R for the scare factor, which is awesome.
Either A, proves that it's the most horrifying thing ever to exist, or B, that the rating system is broken. Either or. probably both, actually. Anyway.
The last thing about this film, I forgot what was her thing. It's got an old-fashioned feel to it.
Yeah.
And as I was watching it, I was thinking some things. When I read some stuff later, kind of confirmed it. But I think, down the road, we'll put this up there with The Exorcist and Poltergeist.
Wow. But James Wan's last film, Insidious, really also kind of had a 70s feel.
Yeah.
A feel that, you know, this kind of, what I and many consider the golden age of horror cinema, really kind of captured that feel in a way I don't think anybody else has.
And I think this one's helped, you know, this is a period piece as it's set in the 70s.
Yes, it is set in the
70s. And so that really reaffirms that mm-hmm. feel. And I loved Insidious. I thought it was a blast.
Mm, absolutely.
But Insidious is B-movie double feature garbage compared to The Conjuring.
Whoa.
I really enjoyed it.
Wow.
All right, that's a strong word, sir.
Man,
I'm excited.
He is fired up. Dustin.
Man, that is great. I'm excited about a couple movies coming up. You know, I'm excited about summer being over.
I am too, actually. You know, I'm starting to get the fatigue.
Very disappointing summer, I would say.
I'm in the loud, smashy, bangy, clangy, you know, flashy.
I'm tired of filmmakers making me look at 9/11. I'm really sick of it.
And so I'm ready for that to be over and move into some more thoughtful things. Of course, the Oscar bait's coming and all that.
Well, we got a couple of good films to milk out of summer yet. Elysium.
Elysium might be good. Gravity. Well, it's going to be on in October before it comes out.
Elysium
so.
Looks good.
Elysium.
I'm kind of excited about Two Guns. I'm sure it'll be popcorn fest.
I'm making a face at Arthur that you can't see right now. You mean.
Denzel Washington.
You mean Safe House Part 2, right?
I mean Mark Wahlberg.
You mean Safe House Part 2.
I mean two undercover cops get screwed by the man, which we've never seen before.
You mean Safe House Part 2.
Yeah, I mean I want to see it too, because it's going to be fun. Yeah,
it's going to be fun.
You mean Denzel Shepard's...
Denzel being Denzel, Marky Mark being Marky Mark, as two undercover agents.
Denzel shadows and mentors a snarky white guy, the sequel, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. Did you guys see Safe House?
I did.
No one is house. Safe House. Not a good movie. I'm sorry.
Well, and so, you know, I'm ready for that to be over.
Yes.
I'm quite ready for that to be over. And I'm excited about a couple movies coming out. And I may have mentioned one of these before, but I want to mention it again just because I'm excited that we're finally getting closer to something good entering cinemas. First of all, next month, August, The Spectacular Now is going to get its general and wide release. I caught it at the Dead Center Film Festival because the original novel was written by a local Oklahoma
mm-hmm.
author from Moore. It was actually set in Moore.
Really?
And the novel was.
Hey.
The film is set somewhere in Georgia. There's lots of Spanish moss.
Assholes.
So it looks that way. but it is fantastic, and I intend to give them more money because
awesome.
I want this to do well, and I want to be well thought of. I saw some of the actors and actresses on the press junket recently, and that just makes me very happy.
I'm looking forward to it.
Also, I mentioned before, perhaps, but Wolf of Wall Street is coming soon.
Oh, my goodness, that trailer.
Marty Pills is going to make us another movie, and it looks like he's going to make the comedy. And Matthew McConaughey is ridiculous, is anorexic and ridiculous.
In that trailer.
In that trailer.
He is so funny.
I am so excited to see.
Wait,
just...
can I get you a drink? sorry, the beer doesn't allow us to drink on duty.
The beer doesn't allow us to drink on duty.
Let's talk about DiCaprio in that trailer.
Oh my god. It's a whole other role.
It's straight
for
up broad comedy.
I've never seen Marty do this.
No.
And I am very, he is a master of genre. And I'm just thinking, this is him doing his Cary Grant comedy.
I mean, it definitely seems like it's got its darker moments, but yeah, it looks like a straight-up comedy.
And I'm really excited to see a Cary Grant comedy come from him. And starring Leonardo DiCaprio as Cary Grant, mind you. And so, very, very excited about that. And finally, the last thing that's got me fired up in pop culture is the release on Criterion, Spy number 666, The Devil's Backbone. It came in the mail.
I wonder how many strings were pulled to make that happen.
Oh, I don't know, but oh, I am so happy to have it in my possession. It is pretty.
That sounds like a group. That sounds like something we should do together.
Oh,
as a group.
Yeah. I am in for that. Maybe our own little audio commentary. What do you think?
I've never seen it before.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, it's one of my Del Toro blind spot.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, we'll talk more off air about that and see if we can do something like that for maybe a possible show at some point in the future.
I'd be into it.
So
a little bonus show for you, ladies and gents. We know you appreciate that.
That's something we can think about. So I'm very, very excited about that. And speaking of Guillermo del Toro, as we wrap up, what's got us fired up? Moving on to what's next. We got to talk about what's next.
That was a hell of a segue.
A little film by Mr. Guillermo del Toro that's available on the streaming. No, it's not Mimic.
No,
it's not Mimic. It's going to be the good one. It's going to be Hellboy, one of his most personal films, he says.
Yeah.
And
he's come up a lot in the last 3 weeks, and I can't believe we just out of nowhere like, oh yeah, by the way, Hellboy's streaming.
Yeah.
So we got to do it. I mean, we've been talking about it too much lately.
Absolutely. So the Del Toro will find his way.
To invoke a Del Toro rule on Dustin.
You know, it could be done.
I think we might need to. Yeah,
it might be.
I think we all need to have at least one filmmaker. We gotta shut it down.
Gotta shut it down.
Shut it down.
All right. Well, after we do the perhaps the Devil's Backbone show, we can talk about that.
I'm excited. So yeah, Hellboy is our film for next week,
and it's gonna be great. And I'm just very, very excited to be doing that. And I'm excited to be around a table with these two guys talking about movies. And excited to be able to share our experience with you all out there, the dear listener. We hope you would share that with us on Facebook. Tell us about what we said and what we said wrong and what we said right. And by golly, get out there, go watch a movie, and have a good conversation with somebody you care about. Because that's really what makes this whole thing worthwhile. And until then, we'll see you next time.
So, real quick, while I have the time, have you guys seen the YouTube video Batman in Classic Movies?
No.
Somebody has went in and superimposed themselves into classic movies, and it looks flawless. For example, the first one is Harry Potter. It's the Wingardium Leviosa thing. Batman has been superimposed on Hermione. So, he's like, "You're doing it wrong. It's Wingardium Leviosa." And Ron says...
Word.
Well, if it's so good, why don't you do it? He responds however Ron responded in the movie. And then it cuts to Flickwick, and all you hear is, "Avada Kedavra." And then it goes on for like, there's two parts, and there's like, I don't remember. They do Casablanca, Wizard of Oz,
that sounds
Harry Met Sally. Oh, yeah.